You know, these stories are short enough that, unlike most stories I've worked on, they can occasionally present themselves whole or very close to it.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with novelist and short story writer Kevin Brockmeyer about his book, The Ghost Variations, 100 Stories.
In the case of this book, the whole collection is bound together by the page constraints of each and every story, by the idea of ghostliness, which is always present, either loudly or quietly. And also, again, it was suggested to me by some other sensibility that seemed to be penetrating the work.
Ghosts and other paranormal phenomena on Arts and Letters. Yeah. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Miller, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
Nobody see me. I'm invisible. Oh, you can look right through. Baby, baby, I'm a ghost.
Boo. Today, we'll be talking with writer Kevin Brockmeyer about his collection of ghost stories, The Ghost Variations, 100 Stories, which enact and reanimate fables, out-of-joint time sequences, and animal stories.
It's been my experience that the moment you put an animal down on the page, something unusual happens, which is that it begins to seem as if it possesses a fuller potential for personhood.
100 tightly woven ghostly variations on Arts and Letters.
Everything has changed. Changed. Can't get no credit. Credit. No ghost dollar bills. Money. Baby, baby, I'm a ghost. Baby, baby, I'm a ghost. Baby, I'm a ghost. Baby, baby, I'm a ghost. Baby, baby, I'm a spooky ghost.
Kevin Brockmeyer, The Ghost Variations, 100 Stories. Welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I particularly love short stories, and they're called a variety of different things. Short shorts, or what are some of the other names?
Short shorts, flash fiction, very short stories, sudden fiction.
So you decided to write 100 stories that were exactly a page long. Why?
Well, first of all, it's 100 stories that are a page long in manuscript form.
Right.
In the final book, I'm guessing there'll be roughly a couple pages apiece. Each of them is somewhere between 450 and 550 words, just to meet the page length. My writing is always informed by my reading. And over the past few years, increasingly, I've been drawn to very short forms and seeing the energy in those stories. Discovering writers not only from America, but from across the world who are or had once done exciting and curious work in that form. And more than anything else, I wanted to see if I could try my hand at it. So when I was thinking about this project, before I had written so much as a single word, what I knew about the book was that it would be exactly 100 stories long, and that all of those stories would be ghost stories, speaking very loosely. Mm-hmm. Some of them, a few of them, are traditional scary ghost stories of the gotcha sort. but most of them deal with the idea of ghosts or ghostliness or the afterlife in other ways, sometimes very symbolic ways. 11. A true story. A certain Russian philosopher maintained that people are not born with their souls, but must labor to create them. Anyone who fails to do so, he insisted, will dissolve upon dying into non-existence. He was partially correct. 12. Indeed, we are not born with our souls. Instead, each of us is born possessing the soul of someone else, which is ours to safeguard, but not to keep. Eventually, if we are lucky, our lives will introduce us to exactly the right person, and the trip lever of some secret drawer will disengage, whereupon our soul will be relinquished to us. Though the likelihood of an even swap, the chance, that is, that the soul we have been stewarding will belong to the same person who has been stewarding ours, is incalculably small. Take that boy, barely 5 years old, kneeling in his front yard beside an agreeable big wet-eyed sheepdog. He listens to her snuffling out a slow, peaceful breath. Then, after half a minute goes by, another. She is sweet and sad, as solemn as a cloud behind her face. Inside her body, the boy thinks, it must sound like a giant cave, a heartbeat for every breath, and a breath for every heartbeat. She is as large as he is, maybe slightly larger. It's hard to be sure, since dogs aren't shaped like people. But there's one thing the boy knows for certain, which is that even though she appeared in his yard only this afternoon, and without any tags, they belong to each other. Best friends, that's what they are. He recognized it immediately, as soon as she came trotting over, flinging her ears back and forth in the sunlight. Now she sits in the grass, cocking her head at him, her pink tongue extending from the slot of her mouth like a skee ball ticket. He runs his hand through her fur. It is white and gray and very soft, feather duster fur. She has run away from home, he thinks. She has no one to love her but him. His mom and dad are stupid and mean and said, no, no stray dogs. You can't invite a stray dog into this house. And he doesn't know if she will be there when he wakes up tomorrow. It hurts, but they both pretend it doesn't. All at once, the boy feels the strangest emptiness he has ever felt, as if he hasn't eaten in days and days. It is 6 o'clock. On an orange October night. For a while, the insects were clicking and buzzing, and now they are chirping, and the sound is so loud that it's straining the light from the sky. Soon the boy's parents will call him back inside. In his pajamas, while he is supposed to be in bed, he will walk over to the window and watch the dog standing beneath the trees, silently asking for him, with the tilt of her brow. After a while, she will pad away down the street, her soul newly enclosed in her body, and the boy will go sprinting off into the rest of his childhood, and then his adolescence. And then his life, in search of whoever might give him his own. The specific Russian philosopher to whom I was referring is Gurdjieff, who does indeed have this idea that's right at the center of his work, that you're born without a soul, and that it's your job as a living being to create your soul, and that most living beings fail to do it, and so simply vanish into non-existence when they die.
Give us this sense of that theme in your work, this idea of existence and non-existence, or what makes a person?
Yeah.
What makes someone whole?
This is a book that's suffused with that theme. And I was asking myself questions about what it means to be or not to be over and over again. And kind of using the idea of being and the idea of non-being as a kind of playground. You know, it's not that the book doesn't take those questions seriously, but it's also willing simply to admit the mystery of them. Now, this story in particular, like, has a very clean exchange. There's a boy and there's a dog, and you eventually learn that the boy was born possessing the soul of the dog. And when he meets the dog, he passes it along to him. And now the boy has to wait and see whether he will ever meet the person who possesses
his own soul.
And I call this one a true story because it's rooted, like a couple of the other stories in the book, more wholly in an incident that actually happened to me than many of the stories are. In this case, I have a very clear memory of being a boy, this boy, at about the age of 6, and a sheepdog appearing in my front yard, and just feeling that this dog belonged to me, and I belonged to him. And my parents wouldn't let me take him in. And I was so upset about that. I thought we were abandoning him and he was my friend. So that material and kind of the way the boy sits with the dog and caresses the dog was generated very directly from something that actually happened to me. And then I endowed it with some ghostliness, which was for the purposes of the book.
And the real story, did the dog run away?
The dog remained in my front yard for a long time.
Huh.
Eventually it left. But, you know, I found the dog in the middle of the day, and I just sat there with it and kind of spoke to my parents, and they told me I couldn't keep him. I was very upset. I was, you know, a kind of a sentimental kid. But, yeah, I went back inside. Like, I said goodbye to the dog because I had to go inside for dinner. And I cried my way through dinner, and I went back out, and the dog was still there in the front yard. So I sat down with it again until it was time for me to go inside and go to bed.
Uh-huh.
And I did look out my window and see the dog still sitting in the front yard, and eventually I fell asleep, and by the time I woke up, the dog was gone.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's continue our discussion with author Kevin Brockmeyer about his book, The Ghost Variations, 100 Stories.
Parakeets. Not long ago, there lived a man with 3 pet parakeets. The first appareled in jewel tones of green and yellow, the second with a blue brow that faded into a creamy purple breast, and the third an albino with a beanbag-like belly. Every day from dawn to dusk, their chattering permeated the man's sunroom, all blonde wood and arched windows. It was the most calming space in his house, the sunroom, but for a single perplexing defect. A frigid patch against the back wall, roughly the size of a water tank. How was it, the man wondered, that even in high summer, at 3:30 in the afternoon, when his shirt was pasted to his back with sweat, He would feel an alarming chill whenever he passed behind the sofa and to the immediate left of his credenza. Sometimes, walking in or out of the room, he would pause before he had emerged from the temperature well, just to appreciate the sense of disorientation it caused him. Two-thirds of his body warm and comfortable, yet the ice lopping off an arm or a leg, a slice of his foot, the escarpment of his shoulder. One day the man was polishing his hardwoods when, to access a section of the floor, he moved his birdcage into the cold patch. A silence enshrouded the birds. Their feathers flattened. Whether through tiredness or simple absent-mindedness, the man neglected to restore the cage to its spot in the corner. And by the next morning, when he returned, the perches and wires were covered in a verdigris of frost. As he approached, the parakeet stood at attention. Try as he might, he had never been able to extend their vocabulary beyond a few basic words. Birdseed. Not now. Pretty bird. Night-night. Yet now, so quietly he would not have heard them if the air conditioner had not clicked off. The first bird said, "I do not know where I am." And the second said, "I deserve another chance." And, "The wind here is so bitter and it never stops," said the albino. The man felt as if someone had emptied a breath onto the nape of his neck. A marshy smell rose from his armpits. He had always enjoyed riddles, even insoluble ones. But there were riddles, and then there were riddles. He instructed himself to move the cage back to the corner. Do it. Do it. But the cold of the copper bit his fingers to the skeleton. He flinched. He backed away. Without thinking, because he had said it so many times before, he asked, "Who's a pretty bird?" The parakeets eyed him with a daunting directness. "Is someone there? Will you speak up? Let us out. Come closer. I can almost hear you. Come closer. Come closer. Let us out." Between the bars of the cage, everything was green and yellow, like the grass at daybreak. Or blue and violet, like the last brush of the evening. Or fat and white, like the sun pinned in the sky. Until he reached for the latch, and the darkness rushed in. Yeah, I keep turning to animals. So the writer Joy Williams, I stumbled across her list of recommendations for the short story writer. And most of those recommendations were very familiar to people who are accustomed to reading points of advice from other writers. However, one of Joy Williams' suggestions to writers working on short stories is that they always include an animal somewhere in the pages of their story to watch over the material and to give it its blessing. This is a very mystical sort of assertion from Joy Williams. And it's the kind of thing that I can imagine certain people dismissing because it possesses a certain mysticism. And yet, I've got to admit, I've found it to be the case that when I've incorporated an animal onto the pages of my stories, suddenly they seem to have a kind of life that they didn't have before, as if there are these two little eyes kind of peering out at you from inside the material. And I can't justify that. I've just found it to be so that when I write a story in which it's either about an animal or in which an animal even appears, something unusual happens, and it takes on a kind of presence that it would not otherwise have possessed. things that fall from the sky. Following the rain of ghosts, the earth smelled of moss and black pepper, and buildings appeared to waver at their boundaries. But then the sun came out, drying the puddles and lifting the dimpling marks from the soil. And the world seemed like itself again, untransformed. For a few weeks, the city maintained its routines. The school bells rang at 9 and 4. The cars stacked up at the stoplight. On Saturdays, the produce market busied itself by the river. It was easy to forget that morning when, without so much as a thunder crack, the air had filled with the spinning forms of a million dead spirits. Somehow no one heard the change say, "I'm coming." Spring was beginning to turn to summer when the first trees yielded their crop of ghost fruit. All at once, there they were, a sea of soft-specked blue globes that bobbed from the tips of the branches. Nearly irresistible to pick, and once picked, to bite into. When pierced, the skin produced a tiny leap of smoke. The flesh was not smoky to the tongue, though, but flossy and succulent. Raw, it tasted like an oddly nectary cucumber. Baked, not like grapes per se, but like the grape additive in sodas and lollipops. Delicious. The seeds were as hard as BBs and had to be enucleated from a milky green cleft in the center. But otherwise, the fruit seemed to satisfy the exact hunger it generated, and to satisfy it perfectly. Soon after you ate one, though, it would happen. A door would swing open inside you, and through it would come drifting the specter of another person. To have a second identity nestling alongside your own, clouding around inside you and making your fingertips tingle, was invigorating, but also disconcerting. Homebodies who had never traveled farther than the state park surprised themselves by talking about the crowded subways of Tokyo or the cave tombs of Sulawesi. Children complained that their spouses didn't love them anymore. A cashier at the ballpark recited a poem she insisted she had written in a language she said she didn't recognize. These additional personalities rarely lasted longer than a day or two, but everyone, to the last man and woman, was sorry to see theirs go. A life felt so much bigger with two sets of memories inside it. By November, most of the harvest had been consumed, most of the ghosts digested. By January, there was hardly anybody who had not become resigned to possessing one and only one spirit. But by March, it was discovered that the BBs had taken root in the soil. By summer, at the edges of certain fields, they were growing into dainty saplings. And by September, the first hard blue kernels could be seen budding between their leaves. From then on, in at least this one city, people lived out their days with a sense of expansiveness and reverent mystery, nourished by this world and also by some other.
This is an odd story. Many things are happening within it, like with the ghost story with the little boy and the dog.
Uh-huh.
There's this thing that happens that you set up as a philosophical constraint, and then you play it out.
Yeah.
In this one, it begins with a torrent.
The ghosts saturate the soil, and then they give rise to these trees, and the trees blossom with fruit.
And people eat the fruit.
People eat the fruit, and it turns out the fruit contains earlier spirits, and they can feel those spirits inside their own. And one of the reasons that I wanted to incorporate this story into the little packet I'm reading from with you today is that it's got a hopeful ending. And, you know, a lot of my stories are mournful or end on a down note, and it felt important to me to include a story that ends with a sense of expansiveness and reverent mystery, nourished by this world and also by some other. That's the most optimistic possible ending I can imagine.
Thank you very, very much. Welcome. I think it's a phenomenal piece of work.
Thank you.
And I know how long it took, but at the same time, there's such joy in it, and it's vibrant. So thank you very much for all of this.
Absolutely.
The souls of all my dears have flown to the stars. The souls of all my dears have flown to the stars. I see, I hear, I touch you drawing near.
Oh. Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters, John Spencer.
Boo.
Brad Bird.
I feel just like a ghost walking around in the backwoods of your mind.
Bark. And Iris Dement.
The souls of all my dears have flown to the stars.
Thank you to composer Amos Cochran for the amazing and haunting soundscapes. A special thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the story editing advice. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the program. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Kevin Brockmeyer for focusing attention on the short story as he created 100 Ghost Variations. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed these words from Joy Williams. You must stop worrying about why things happen and wonder what they mean when they do.